You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Katoa, ko Jemima Houston, tōku ingoa, no mai hare mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for the 16th of November. My name is Jemima and I'm your host. I am not joined in studio by Emily because obviously we're still in level 3, but Emily Val is our new producer on the Tuesday Wire, so she has created her first piece for the show today. It's very exciting, really nice to have some new voices on The Wire. I've said it before and I'll say it again, but throughout the week you'll hear some new voices on each of The Wire shows as we've moved out of semester 2 and we're now in the summer roster for the news team. So there are some people that have stepped up and put their name forward to produce pieces for The Wire, so get excited for that. Some new perspectives and some new thoughts and ideas for pieces, so yeah, it's exciting. Nice to have new voices on The Wire. Anyway, if I akine, we have some great stuff coming up for you today. Emily brings us her first piece where she speaks to Police Minister Porter Williams about a latest firearms mandate. I speak to Deborah Hart, who is the chair of the Holocaust Centre New Zealand. And we speak about some of the comparisons that have been made by anti-vaccination protesters between the Holocaust and the government's COVID restrictions here in New Zealand and how that is impacting the Jewish community. I also catch up with Auckland Women's Refuge chairperson, Toafu Havili, and speak about how the refuge has been coping in this long lockdown. If you've been tuned into the Tuesday Wire for quite some time, you will know that I spoke to Toafu quite early on in lockdown, so it's interesting to have a chat and see how they've been going. And then finally, I speak to Oxfam Aotearoa on the COVID support New Zealand has provided to Papua New Guinea and whether it is enough and whether New Zealand needs to step up more. He aha o whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tuku pātui mai, you can send me through a text on 5395. Also, after the show, koe e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, he pakihiri rokiroki, maronga i te pai, tukutuku o erarangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. If you head to the BCasts page and then you head to The Wire, you can check out all the awesome pieces that get produced for this show. We podcast them straight afterwards, so if you have tuned in halfway through to a previous show, it'll be up there on the website. Have a listen to the full piece. Anyway, let's crack into Emily's first story.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
A new firearms unit has been announced by the Labour government as the next step to lessening gun violence in New Zealand. Police Minister Porter Williams discusses the functions of the new unit.
Could you explain the purpose and objectives of the firearms unit?
So we've made a commitment in terms of firearm safety, and this is one of the most important elements of that. The unit will house the register, which will allow police to have an idea of who is applying for firearms licenses, how we can control kind of the sale of firearms, and how many firearms somebody has. And why that's really important is that up until this point, we've had about 30 years when we haven't had a register, so we have no idea how many firearms are in our community. This gives us the ability from this point on to know who has firearms, how they're securing them, how they're being sold and distributed, and how many people have. So it allows us to have a much safer community environment that understanding is really important.
Will the firearms unit have like an internal or external targets that must be met regarding firearm regulations or seeing how many you can register?
That will be, a lot of that stuff is operational. What it will do is it will set some very tight criteria around who is fit and proper. So who is a fit and proper person to have a firearm? What it will also do, it will put some regulations and some constraints around the sale of firearms. One of the things that really concerns me at the moment is that you can, if you have a firearms license, you can go and purchase as many firearms as you like. Now that's, on the face of it, you know, you may need a firearm for sport or for recreation or for work possibly, or even for gathering kai. But I'm concerned that we don't know how many firearms are in our community. So when police turn up to a particular job, they're unaware of, but potentially unaware that a firearm may be present. And one of the examples that has been quoted to me, of course, is when police were asked to attend someone who was self-harming. When they arrived there, they found dozens of weapons in the home. So for them not to know that before they go is quite dangerous. But now we've got the ability to understand that much better than we have before.
When will the firearms unit be fully up and running and operational in New Zealand?
So by the end of next year, at the moment we've got a transitional manager in place who's looking at employing people to join the unit and working on all of the regulations and all the information that needs to go in place before the unit is up and running. So yeah, can't wait really. I wish it would happen sooner. But if you can appreciate it, it's been a while since we've had a register. So we have to make sure that we get everything right in that space. So yeah, they're working very hard on that.
And how will the firearms unit work with the already existing framework for gun ownership and regulation in New Zealand?
Well, it will tighten it up. It will put some real parameters around how weapons are moved, how they're sold, how many you can hold, how you secure them and how you store them and how they're transported. So all of these things make it harder for weapons to get into the general community, to get into the hands of people that might harm us or harm others.
And the use of firearms in New Zealand, as we've seen, has increased dramatically in the last few years. Do you think this new regulatory body, combined with the current approach of policing guns that we already have in New Zealand, is sufficient to combat this rise in gun violence?
Well, we can never design a perfect system, but we can get as close to one as possible. The big gap that we've had is we've had 30 years of not knowing really how many firearms are out there. I mean, we've known who's registered, but we don't know registered firearm owners how many weapons they've had. And we're not entirely sure that our register of firearms owners has been up to scratch either. If you recall, after the March 15 tragedy, the Royal Commission of Inquiry asked for police to do a couple of pieces of work. And the first piece of work was to make sure that when we're registering people to own a firearm, that we are really clear about them passing the fit and proper test, that we are really clear that make sure that they've got the right people supporting those applications. They do everything they can to make sure that is a robust system. And the police have gone a long way to really improving that. What the unit will do will assist in that, but on top of that, it will make regulations to ensure that the use, the transportation, the securing of firearms is added as well. So it just really adds an element to that. The other thing that the Royal Commission of Inquiry also required was that the police restore some trust and confidence in the people of New Zealand that they could do a really good job. So when we were looking at the unit and how to design it, it was really important that we got that balance right. So the fact that we have landed on a branded business unit within police that's independent of police, that reports to the commissioner, and one that also the Ministerial Arms Advisory Group said that they preferred, that was their preferred option of unit, really speaks to us helping the police to build that trust and confidence back again with the people of New Zealand.
there seems to be, as you've said before, a lot of steps taken to do gun reform, ownership and legislation in New Zealand, especially since 2019. Are there any more changes around this topic that you or the New Zealand Police would like to see implemented in the future?
Well, we're working, this is part of a wider process, as you can appreciate. You know, we've got the Royal Commission of Inquiry recommendations, and there's a lot of work happening across all of government, across the justice sector in particular. You know, we started, you know, very soon after the March 15 attacks by ensuring that we took 60,000 military-styled semi-automatic weapons off the streets, which was the first part of the program. The police have been actively engaged and ensuring that we seize as many illegal firearms as possible. There have been another, you know, 8,700 in that time alone. And the work that we're doing with the police to support them, building capability, building police numbers, all adds to that. And we've got some specific police recruits that will be working on organised crime, which really just helps us in our fight to take illegal weapons off the streets and just help our communities be safer.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks, Emily.
That was Police Minister Potua Williams speaking with Emily Bow about the new firearms unit.
Thank you so much for that one, Emily. As I said at the top of the show, that was Emily's first produced piece for The Wire. So if you have any thoughts on any of the pieces on the show today, do send me through a text. 5395 is the number. You're on the Tuesday Wire. We'll be right back with some more good newsy bits for you after a little break. This is Marlena Shaw, Woman of the Ghetto. You're on 95BFM.
Ghetto. I was born and raised in a ghetto. I'm a woman of the ghetto. Won't you listen, won't you listen, won't you listen to me there just later? How do you raise your kids in a ghetto? How do you raise your kids in a ghetto? Do you feed one child and starve another? Won't you tell me, legislator? I'm strong, true. I know that my eyes ain't blue, but you see, does your heart feel late at night? How does your heart feel late at night? Does it beat with shame? And does it beat with pride? Oh, won't you tell me, legislate?
New Leaf Kombucha is New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom.
Everything you need from your kombucha. Five different varieties on tap, even more in bottles, all brewed organically with no flavourings, colourings or preservatives.
Try their new Hop Butcher, New Leaf's trademark non-alcoholic beer brewed with kiwi hops. Everything you love about beer without the beer.
New Leaf Kombucha, New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom. Visit today at 37 Crummer Road, Grey Lynn. Door sales only during level 3. Also, they've got a talking parrot. Come on!
Daddy, Daddy, what have you brought me from your travels?
For you, my child, oranges from Spain.
Daddy, Daddy, have you a gift for me?
For you, my sweet, this carved jade badger from the Khotan region of China.
And me, Daddy?
Ah, for my favourite, a white label cameo 12-inch all the way from the land of the good groove.
This slaps, Papa!
Land of the Good Groove with the legendary Murray Kamek.
It's Murray Kamek.
Who's that lady? Who's that lady?
Land of the Good Groove. Every Friday, 1 to 2 p.m., only on 95 BFM.
At 95 BFM.
The Student Radio Network should have awards.
At Radioactive.
Student Radio Network staying silent on awards I sing.
At RDU.
Independent Music.
At Radio Control.
I've had an amazing idea.
At Radio 1.
Everyone keeps talking about these.
You asked for it, so I hope you're happy now. The Student Radio Network Awards are here for 2021, featuring
People's Choice Award, brought to you by Parrot Dog. 2021 SRN Top 10, brought to you by Audio Culture. Outstanding Achievement Award, brought to you by the New Zealand Music Commission.
And so much more glitz, glamour and glory. The Student Radio Network Awards, December 11th, streamed live and simulcast across the Student Radio Network.
And we couldn't do it without New Zealand On Air, Pro Gear and Auckland UNESCO City of Music.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
You're on the Tuesday Wire on 95BFM. My name is Jemima. I'm your host. And Emily is my producer and is producing from the safety of her bubble at home. Friday, the 20th of August, was the last time I spoke with Auckland Women's Refuge about how people could seek assistance at and support the refuge during Level 4. At that stage, we were only 3 days into lockdown. Now, Auckland has been in lockdown for 91 days, and a lot has changed since those early days of the Delta outbreak. I wanted to speak to Auckland Women's Refuge to see how operations have changed for them throughout these changes, and also whether the organisation feels as though it has been supported throughout this unprecedented time. I spoke to Chairperson Tofu Havili about this. We spoke way back in August, and lockdown has dragged on a lot longer than I think many of us thought it would. How has Auckland Women's Refuge found the last over 13 weeks of lockdown?
Still the same, still doing the same work as in Level 4. Our staff are still working from home, and there's some skeleton staffing also in the office just for operations and administration purposes. And they take turns going in, but most of the time our staff are still working from home, which is very operable with what we're going through at the moment. And also still doing the same mahi with our clients in the safe house and also our clients in the community. So there's not really much change at the moment. Everybody's still doing what they've been doing in Level 4. It's level 3.2 at the moment. So what we have been doing in Level 4 is still what we're doing in Level 3.
So it didn't change much for you in terms of operations or being able to provide assistance. It's sort of been running the same way.
Still running the same way. Like I said before, in August, Level 4 came in, but In refuge life, every day is a crisis. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know who's going to walk through your doors, and you don't know how many clients you're going to be intaking for the day. So intakes, client welfare checks via phone or home visit is still ongoing, and even the work behind the scenes in the office, the head office in St. Luke's, is still going as normal. But at the same time, we're still keeping to the guidelines of each level, alert level, for our staff's safety. Most are on virtual conferences with their clients, and some that needs to be attended to, like dropping off food parcels or that. That's what we do in the community.
So just to go over some of the work that you do specifically, obviously you mentioned food parcels and the safe house and being on calls with people, but could you just sort of run over quickly what Auckland Women's Refuge provides to the community?
What we provide is that we have clients in the community, so our advocate team, they're the ones that looks after our clients in the community and also our clients in our safe house or residential. So each day they follow up with their clients that's assigned either to them, and they follow up to see if they need any support, and whatever the essential support that they need, our advocates will allocate a time that they will do a virtual or support them with liaising with WINS or housing or emergency housing. And for food parcels, it's families in the safe house and also families in the community. When we identify or they contact our advocacy team, that there's a shortage of food in the whare and it's not benefit day or they haven't got their pay yet, our advocate team still prepares them with our donations coordinator and takes them out to our clients in the community. And our donations coordinator is the one that organises all the food needs in the safe house.
Great, that's an awesome rundown. Thank you. Now, how has support been throughout this period? Have you been offered any additional government support or council support, or have you seen more people in the community reaching out to help with Women's Refuge in terms of food parcels?
We've got overwhelming support from Kiwi Harvest, who never fails us, bringing in fresh veggies and fruits and also meat and produce to our whare every Wednesday and Friday. And we all ration those out to our clients in the community and also in the safe house. And we've also, Jemima, been getting a lot of aroha monetary from the public and community, supporting us for food for our women and also for the work we do in the community. And other donations of food also from community people that rings us and offers their support and their whatever they can do to help us with our women and children. So it's quite overwhelming. As we all know, we're an NGO and, of course, we need money all the time. We have funding that was allocated to us through National Office last year, and we still got that funding, and we rationed that out just to make it worth during the COVID levels this year. So we happened to save some last year, and we and all our clients in the community and in the safe house has benefited from that. There was some left, so we left it for emergencies like this with the lockdown that happened in August. But overall, the overwhelming aroha from the community and individuals has been overwhelming with supporting our refuge and our organisation, and also sending messages of love and support and giving out their time if we need anyone to come in to support our workers here on the site.
If somebody was looking for help with Women's Refuge, or if you were looking to give help to Women's Refuge, how can you go about that? What can people do if they're seeking help and also if they're looking to give donations, food or money?
We run our crisis line 24/7, so if somebody's one of us are always on the is always on shift, and we find most of our donors ring in during our crisis line time. So our number is always called by people who want to donate. So that's 09-378-7635, and the crisis line, if there are women out there who are living in the who are experiencing violence in your bubble, we have our crisis line that's 24/7, and there's 0800 refuge. And we have a website that's www.awrefuge.org.nz, and also in there, Jemima, there's give a little link if you want to donate, and there's also referrals that you can message us, and there's confidentiality and privacy in that on that site where we pick up sometimes messages from women needing help in a community or women that are currently living or experiencing violence in their bubble. So we pick that up as referrals also and send it to our advocacy team. And they're the ones who follow up and update the team on what's happening and what intake we're taking every week or every day. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways to contact us, but...
That was Auckland Women's Refuge Chairperson Tuafu Havili speaking on how the refuge has been coping in this long extended lockdown. If you are seeking support or are feeling unsafe in your bubble, to reiterate what Tuafu has said, please call Auckland Women's Refuge office at 09378 7635, or you can call the National Women's Refuge 24/7 crisis line at 0800 Refuge, which is 733 843. Also, if you are wanting to donate to the Auckland Women's Refuge, you can head to www.awrefuge.org. www.foodbank.org.nz, or you can call their office number to organise a time to donate essential food items. You can also head to the National Women's Refuge website and gift a safe night, which is a very quick and easy thing to do to support those in the community. You're on The Wire on 95BFM. This is the Tuesday Wire. I'm Jemima, I'm your host. Emily is producing her first show with me today, but from the safety of her bubble at home. We'll be right back after a little song, but her first, here is Kate Envy.
Don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
You're back on the Tuesday Wire. The Holocaust Centre of New Zealand is calling for anti-lockdown protesters to stop misusing the Holocaust and the Star of David. At anti-lockdown, anti-vaccination protests, New Zealand's COVID-19 restrictions and vaccination mandates have been compared to the Holocaust by protesters. Chair of the Holocaust Centre of New Zealand, Deborah Hart, says this is insensitive, and if people wish to protest, they should not trivialise an event that caused severe generational trauma for the Jewish people. Here is Deborah on that now. Let's start with the comparisons anti-vaccination protesters have been making between New Zealand's COVID-19 restrictions and the Holocaust. What can you tell me about this and sort of how this has been happening?
Well, what we're seeing is protesters using the Holocaust to make a comparison to what's happening with vaccine mandates and what the government's doing. And the use of the Yellow Star of David, which was used by the Nazis. And really, this is a complete false equivalence. And to understand why, you have to understand what the Holocaust was. And the Holocaust was a deliberate attempt to exterminate the Jews. And key to it was the systematic implementation of extermination techniques. And of course, many other people were impacted and persecuted as well, the gay community, the Roma people, disabled. To say that what the government is doing with in relation to COVID is even remotely like what happened in the Holocaust is ridiculous. Ridiculous and a complete false equivalence.
So let's talk about how this is potentially impacting the Jewish community in New Zealand. How have people been feeling when they've been seeing this sort of language being used at these protests?
Well, I think both people in the Jewish community are completely appalled at the lack of sensitivity to what the Holocaust was and what Jewish people went through. 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. 1.5 million of them were children. So, you know, I'm really quite appalled at the insensitivity of this. And for us, it underlines that we need to do more around education so people understand what the Holocaust actually was and what it isn't. And many people very hurt by these comparisons, particularly as, you know, when you make these kinds of comparisons, it delegitimizes what actually happened in the Holocaust. It belittles it. If it is to be compared with something trying to safeguard life, it basically says the Holocaust wasn't as appalling and murderous as it actually was.
It does feel that comparing it to the Holocaust, calling the government Nazis, it sort of feels in a way that they're using those terms quite lightly compared to what they actually were and what they actually mean.
What they're doing is using it as a shorthand, even though they seem blissfully unaware of what the Holocaust actually was. They know it was something terrible. So what they're saying is the government is causing something really terrible. But words actually matter. And the Holocaust was an actual something. And to try and say that the government are acting like Nazis and causing a Holocaust is just ridiculous. And it makes these people look completely ignorant and insensitive.
Just to go back to your point that you made about more education being necessary to perhaps prevent this sort of language being used at protests like this, do you think that the government actually needs to say something about it?
Well, I don't know if it's the government's role to say things like that, but it certainly is ours. And at the Holocaust Centre of New Zealand, you know, one of the things that we do is educate people about the Holocaust and what it was and what it wasn't and what it is that we have to be aware of to ensure that we don't have, you know, these kinds of things happening. So that squarely is the job of the Holocaust Centre of New Zealand. And we believe that every child in this country should learn about the Holocaust, because it was such a pivotal event in global history, and because of its power to inspire and empower action against anti-Semitism, discrimination and apathy. The protesters had every right to protest, but the way that they do it is really important, and they shouldn't do it by appropriating other people's symbols and tonga, like the Star of David, which is a Jewish symbol. Bad enough that it was misappropriated by Hitler and the Nazis, but now we have the anti-vaxxer movement doing the same thing, which is, there's an irony in that, of course. And they have a right to protest, but they need to do it responsibly, and they need to do it in a way that doesn't cause offence and hurt to Jewish people.
Now, I just have one final question, just to sort of blow the context out a little bit, rather than just the protests here in New Zealand, but wider context. How regularly is Holocaust-related terms, language used in sort of movements or causes? In my mind, I'm sort of thinking, is it something that's used quite often online, or is this something you see quite often on sort of an international, wider scale as well?
Yeah. Look, even though we know that there's a decreasing understanding and comprehension of what the Holocaust actually was, we're seeing the Holocaust invoked for all number of causes. It's flung around to be shorthand for any number of grievances. And so we are seeing that a lot, and really it's just really quite unsuitable and really insensitive to be doing that. It trivialises the Holocaust and diminishes the enormity of what the Nazis actually did. But if you talk to Holocaust centres worldwide, they will tell you the same thing, that the Holocaust is invoked for any number of causes. And, of course, people are labelled as Nazis for the same kind of reason. It's shorthand for terrible, appalling behaviour. But something is an atrocity.
And isn't necessarily used in the right context.
Well, words actually matter. And when you call something a Holocaust, it means something. And when you call someone a Nazi, it actually means something. I don't think anybody could reasonably say that the government is trying to systematically exterminate people.
Yeah.
Their intent isn't to exterminate. And we have one of the lowest death rates from COVID in the world. So, in actuality, that's not what they're doing either.
That was Holocaust Centre of New Zealand Chair Deborah Hart speaking on why the centre is calling for anti-lockdown protesters to stop trivialising the Holocaust and the Star of David. You're on The Wire on 95BFM. This is the Tuesday Wire. If you have any thoughts on any of the pieces on the show today, do send me through a text, 5395. We'll be right back with one last piece where I talk to Oxfam Aotearoa about New Zealand's assistance to Papua New Guinea during the pandemic. But first, here is Helado Negro with There Must Be a Song Like You.
Loving, overlooking, language. I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
This is the Tuesday Wire, and my name is Jemima, and I'm your host. Over the weekend, Associate Foreign Minister Opito Williams announced that a medical and logistics team had been sent from New Zealand to Papua New Guinea to assist with the COVID-19 crisis there. The Papua New Guinea government had requested this sort of assistance from partnering countries, and Minister Williams said that New Zealand is committed to supporting our Pacific neighbours to get through the pandemic. Oxfam Aotearoa says this is a good start, but more needs to be done. I spoke to their communications and advocacy director, Dr. Joe Spratt, this morning about New Zealand's support for Papua New Guinea. We talked about how we're standing up as a good neighbour to our Pacific neighbours, and we also had a little bit of a chat about what the COVID situation is actually like in PNG. Here they are now.
Oxfam Aotearoa, we think this is a good start. It comes on top of about $14 million that the government has given over the last 2 years as the Papua New Guinea has gone through three waves of the coronavirus pandemic. This third wave has been the most severe, and the country really is in a crisis situation and has asked for help. So this this team that's gone up for a month is a great start, but we don't think it's enough. The situation there is pretty awful. It is the biggest Pacific Island country, our neighbour of 9 million people, and as recently said by our Foreign Minister, Minister Mahuta, they're part of our family. And when your family's in crisis, you really need to do a bit more than just send up a small team. We can certainly be giving a lot more support. And Papua New Guinea is also our biggest aid program, so we do have the capacity to do a bit more there.
So just to talk a little bit further about what the situation is like in Papua New Guinea at the moment, how has COVID happened there? What sort of situation are they in now? Is there currently, is it quite rife with COVID? Are vaccination rates going well? What is the situation?
I think to fully answer that question, it's good to try and get in your head what Papua New Guinea looks like on a day-to-day basis without the virus. And so it's a country that doesn't have many roads at all. Telecommunications are challenging. Most people live in really remote areas and walk or use boats to get from place to place. And the health system was extremely weak. So people might have to walk for a day to get to a health clinic, and then supplies are very limited. Just doesn't look like New Zealand. So the infrastructure and the institutions weren't there to begin with. And so then when you put a coronavirus outbreak on top of that, and Delta, which we all know how terribly fast that spreads, has really hit the country hard. And it's difficult to know the exact numbers because there is such limited testing and such limited ability to record and share information. But the official number is that there's over 30,000 cases in this wave and well over 400 deaths. But everybody acknowledges that this is is an underestimate. The numbers of cases and deaths will be far higher than that. And certainly talking to colleagues in Papua New Guinea, they talk about people dying in the villages and two people dying in families. And just the numbers seem a lot higher when you're talking to people on the ground. The vaccination rates, vaccines have been very slow to take on. Again, part of the challenge is the limited health system, but also because people are scared of the vaccination. And of course, they do get information through social media and places like that. So there is a kind of a hesitancy around taking the vaccine because people are just a little bit afraid of what it is and what it means because they don't understand. And there was some really great World Bank research out recently that showed when you gave people a little bit more information, particularly from a health worker, they were more likely to be willing to take the vaccination. So rates there are low at the moment. Some very recent figures that just came out show that about just over 9% of people have two doses. So they're creeping up very slowly, but that's still extraordinarily low. But the good side, the positive side, is if we can get information out to people from health workers and other trusted people, then the vaccination rates are likely to go up. So that's, again, one of the things that our government could be helping with is either funding or health workers to roll out an information campaign around the vaccination to get those vaccination rates up.
So that team that has been sent out over the weekend, they're going to be helping with healthcare and informing the public and administering vaccines. Is that the idea, or are they there for a different reason?
The teams are a mixed bunch. So there's some logisticians from the Defence Force and Fire and Emergency. So they're presumably sort of going to help with the coordination of the emergency response and getting supplies and information and things, sort of managing it. There are two doctors and three nurses who have gone. So they will, of course, be helping on more of the healthcare side of things. But I think it's really important that local health workers and village health workers are supported with the right information so that they can tell people in their own languages, in their own ways that are appropriate for the cultural context about the vaccination, and people are far more willing to accept the information and trust it when it comes from a person that they trust. So that has to be somebody who is already living there, not necessarily an outsider. So we can definitely help. Outsiders can definitely help. And so many health workers are getting coronavirus and falling sick, and they were limited to start with. So there definitely needs to be more health workers. But alongside that, there's more that can be done to support those health workers who already work hard and know their communities to be doing more.
That makes sense. Now, let's just go back to sort of New Zealand's responsibility to its Pacific neighbours, and as you said, its family, and talking about Papua New Guinea. I understand that support has been offered and there have been teams that have entered Papua New Guinea from Australia and I believe from the US as well. Is that correct?
I'm not 100% sure about the US. The UK definitely has. They've sent a team over of 10 healthcare workers, and Australia's given about $340 million worth of support over the last couple of years through the three waves of the coronavirus outbreak there.
Where is New Zealand sort of sitting in terms of offering help to Papua New Guinea on an international scale in comparison to other countries?
I would say we're at the bottom end, and I find that upsetting because Papua New Guinea is part of the Pacific family, and our government has talked about values of working together and caring for each other and whanaungatanga, this idea of extended family. And Papua New Guinea is part of the Pacific. It's a huge country with 9 million people, and it is our biggest aid program. And we've given approximately $14 million, and so compare that with Australia's $340 million. I mean, and of course Australia would be giving more because they're right next door, and it's a much bigger economy, but we can certainly be doing a lot more than that. And I think more broadly this is one of the challenges when our government doesn't increase its aid budget, and we aren't particularly generous when it comes to aid. There isn't enough there to provide enough in the budget, so then it requires new money. But I think we mobilised, you know, billions of dollars to help New Zealanders get through the coronavirus epidemic in our country. And I think we can certainly offer a little bit more than what we've done for Papua New Guinea.
Now, just to sort of play devil's advocate on that a little bit, what would you say? What would you say to people who might say, well, we have spent billions of dollars here in New Zealand trying to get through the pandemic? You know, the economic situation is not great. We've got businesses falling through in New Zealand. Why should we be sending our money overseas to help other people?
Yeah, sure. And Tali, I understand that argument, and it's certainly something I have sympathy with because people here are struggling as well. I think, though, that we can do both. We are one of the wealthiest countries on earth, and this is a collective problem. You know, this, the whole human family is suffering from coronavirus, and as long as it's anywhere in the world, it's everywhere potentially, because it could mutate again. And we really just need to get everybody to get the vaccination and stop this epidemic so that we can all get out of it together. So yes, we do need to be doing things at home, and I think our government's done a tremendous job on that front, and I think we can be doing more overseas at the same time. It's not an either or here.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the Tuesday Wire for another week. Big thank you to all of you for tuning in and listening to the show. Always love to hear your thoughts, so keep those texts rolling in on 5395. We love to hear your feedback and what you think of the pieces on the show. Big thank you to Emily for producing her first Wire today. Such amazing work. Really, really appreciate all the time that the news team puts in to creating stuff for The Wire and also producing our news bulletins, despite the fact we're still in this long old lockdown and haven't seen many of them for quite some time. Big thank you as well to the people who gave us their time and spoke with us for the show today. That's always amazing. So I hope you have a lovely afternoon out there and that you're taking care. We'll catch you next time. Stay tuned in to BFM. Up next is the 1 to 4 with Jin. We'll be right back.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.